It's my destiny too. It's my fate. These are my people. Why should my family be safe while they're suffering?
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean to fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am.
Here I am with Shai Davidai.
My guest today is one of the strongest activists that I've seen, who has been extremely vocal for the release of the hostages that are being held by Hamas. Yad Corinne Rubin Unger.
Yes.
The longest name I've had on this show so far. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
I should say for people listening in, two things before we start. One, when you record a podcast in advance, you always think like, oh, I just want to make sure that this is not dated by the time it goes out in like a month or two or whenever. This episode, I hope, is dated. I hope that when it comes out, people will be like, we're so glad we don't need to talk about the hostages anymore.
Amen.
And we'll get to that. The other thing I have to tell people, you know, just out of fairness for people watching or listening, is that we didn't know each other until like a few months ago, but I consider you a close friend now. So it's also kind of weird to interview a friend or be interviewed by a friend, but we'll try to make it work.
We'll definitely make it work, but I consider you a close friend too, so thank you.
Liat, I start with the question I start with everyone. What kind of a Jew are you?
I'm that proud, fight for you, be loud, proud. I don't even know how to describe myself. That's a really good question. What kind of Jew am I? I'm the in my blood boils, my DNA, Israeli Jew.
So you're Israeli Jewish, born and raised in the US.
Correct.
So before we get to today, get me to the out of October 6th. Like, how did you, where were you born? How did you get here?
Born and raised in New York, two Israeli parents, three brothers, all born in Israel.
Older brothers?
Older brothers.
Yeah. That tracks.
Yeah.
For some reason, that really tracks.
I have to know brothers. Why.
You have that fighting spirit in you, someone who had to fight to be, you know, to be noticed, but also was obviously like probably like being the only girl, like very loved. But you know how to fight.
That's so interesting. Yeah. Okay. I guess it tracks. My brothers and my parents were born in Israel. We grew up, I grew up on Long Island, and my parents raised us extremely, extremely Israeli. Hebrew music, always Hebrew at home. We weren't allowed to speak English at home at all. We spoke Spanish, Hebrew, or Ladino at home.
Spanish, Hebrew, or Ladino. So why Spanish?
Spanish from the nanny. Okay. My parents had to work, so I had a live-in nanny.
Ladino?
Ladino from my grandparents, and that's like the cultural language. That's how my parents actually figured it out, how to make it in America, is because they opened a furniture store in a Spanish-speaking area. And Ladino is very close to the Spanish, but yeah, so we spoke.
For people who don't know what Ladino is, which is very interesting, but people don't know about it. So Yiddish is to German like Ladino is to Spanish.
To Sephardic Jews, yeah.
To Sephardic Jews, because on the one hand, they were really, really affected by the culture they had to live in exile. Sure. On the other hand, they wanted their own language. So it sounds like Spanish. There's a lot of overlap, but it's its own language.
It's Ladino. Its own language, yes. So, and then English we learned outside of school, in school rather, outside of the house. The identity was just, the Israeli identity was just living, breathing in our house. Every vacation was to Israel, 2-3 months in the summer, Passover, holidays, everything just revolved around Israel.
Did you, as a child, and I'm asking this a little bit because out of self-interest, force my kids to speak Hebrew to me. Like, they can speak English with each other, although I tell them not to, but they need to speak Hebrew to me and I respond in Hebrew. Were you ever resentful of your parents?
I used to get very frustrated. It was like having an entire conversation in Hebrew with my parents, with my father specifically, I remember. And if I'd throw in like one sentence, he would make me repeat the entire thing.
Wow.
From the beginning in Hebrew. And it was frustrating because you just want to get it out. And then today I'm so thankful because when I go to Israel, I have a proper Israeli experience. There is no culture barrier. There's no language barrier. As a kid growing up there, going to the beach, you know, my parents didn't have money to send me to camp. That wasn't also the mentality. Israelis don't, you know, I don't know what it was, but we went to the beach. I had to make friends and I figured it out. And I had friends until today that I met on the beach in Israel that I still communicate with and we're still friends. And I was lucky enough to have that type of experience. But yeah, at the time, I think I was very resentful, but it definitely paid off.
Because one of the things, you know, because this is about Jewish civil rights and big part of Jewish civil rights is the Zionist movement. One of the things that people kind of forget, you know, the Zionist movement was about establishing our homeland, but it was also about establishing us as a people. And it was the renaissance of Hebrew as an everyday language. It was the renaissance of Hebrew as a language of culture, of poetry, of music, of stories. Shalom Aleichem, Chaim Nachman Bialik, like all those, they weren't Israelis. They were Jews who devoted themselves to speaking Hebrew. And one of the things that I've been doing in the past months is encouraging people to be publicly Jewish. And part of being publicly Jewish is maybe leaning into like learning a bit more Hebrew and, you know, connecting with that other half of Jews that live in Israel.
1,000%.
So, and then you grew up very Jewish, very Israeli.
Not observant, but traditional.
Not observant. What does traditional mean to you?
Shabbat dinners were mandatory. We weren't allowed to go anywhere on Friday nights. It was Kiddush. And then Saturday was just like a regular day, but, you know, to be with the family. And my parents had to work usually on Saturdays. But yeah, holidays, synagogue on Yom Kippur generally. Yeah. But those were the big things.
So, but beyond this like family, emotional, maybe spiritual connection to Israel, did you have like an actual connection? Did you engage in any activities with supporting Israel? Any youth movements?
From here in America? No. But going to Israel, I think, was the thing that connected me there. I think it shaped my identity. People ask me about my childhood memories. They're not here, that's for sure. They're all in Israel. You know, my father taking me to where he grew up and me being with my friends and, you know, picking shesek. I don't know how to say shesek in English.
I have no idea.
Let's say like an apricot or some sort of apricot type fruit from the bushes and the trees and the moshavim in Israel, visiting friends. My core memories are in Israel, all of them.
But then at some point you started actively supporting organizing with money. You told me about an IDF unit that you kind of adopted.
Yes. Actually, there's one thing that I should mention. I went to public school growing up in Long Island. I felt different. My friends were allowed to go out Friday nights. They went to this place called Hot Skates, which I'll never forget, on Long Island. And
what was that place?
It's a place where you went roller skating. All the kids went roller skating and, you know, everyone had their first kisses there. And I wasn't allowed to go because it's Friday night and it's Kiddush and it's
family. Your parents didn't have a problem with the first kiss. They had a problem with a kiss on Shabbat.
Definitely not. And at some point I remember coming back from Israel and I asked my parents to send me to Jewish school. I said, I feel different and I want to go to a Jewish school. I want to feel like I'm surrounded by the people who share the same values and culture as me. There were a ton of Jews, but they were just different Jews. They were more American Jews. And so I asked them to put me in an environment that I could feel more connected to the people, that we had more overlap, that maybe other people spent their summers in Israel, where everyone went to camp. I went to Israel. And so I didn't have much in common with the people that I was in school with. So at the age of 12, my parents sold their house. And we moved to Queens so that they could afford also sending to Jewish school. I had to go to a special type of Jewish school because I didn't know how to read and write in Hebrew. So I taught myself over the summer how to read and write in Hebrew.
Wow.
And then they could place me on like a Tanakh level that was, you know, beginner. but I could, you know, excel in AP, you know, secular classes.
I want to focus or highlight just one thing that you said. Your parents sold their house so they can afford to send their kids to Jewish school.
Yeah, just me.
Just you.
Because my brothers are much older than I am. They were already married.
Mm. Or because you're special. But
I'd like to call it the favorite, but
the favorite. But it's a very Jewish thing to, like, even if it's doesn't financially make sense, you put education first.
Yes.
So tell me about adopting an IDF unit.
So I finished school, and I decided actually to move to Israel instead of go to college. I enrolled in college here. I decided not to go to college here. I decided to, 3 days before my car was being shipped down to Florida for college, I called my parents after being in Israel. It's like a graduation trip.
High school graduation,
and said, I'm not going to Nova Southeastern. I just got accepted to Tel Aviv University. Went to Tel Aviv University. Finished my year there, joined the army. Finished my army services, and then came back here, whatever. Finished my master's. Something happened in 2014. Tzuk Eitan.
Tzuk Eitan was the, up until now, the longest war in Gaza. A very shocking and painful war.
Very. And I had just finished my master's at Columbia. And I had just started my first job, and I left my job. Well, I started fundraising for soldiers who were needing things. I heard that there was equipment missing. I was 25 at the time. I started fundraising through Venmo, and I raised, I think it was like $30,000 in like a week and a half or something like that. And
just you?
Just me.
How did you do it? Just so, you know, there's people going to listen and be like, I want to do something like that. I don't want to wait for organizations to start something.
Facebook, WhatsApp, text messages, calling everyone I knew.
So that's the getting the money. But what about like the sending the money? What's the operation there?
I went to Tel Aviv University with a friend who ended up staying also to join the IDF. And he reached out to me and said to me, you know, his unit, Tzanchanim unit, was needing, you know, XYZ gear. And could I help? And that was kind of it. That was essentially what happened. And then I went there. I left my job. I remember I was working on Washington Heights, and I flew out to Israel, and we went and we bought all the gear and we allocated it. And I went into, I drove to Shechem. There was a base there for paratroopers. And we went and we dropped off all the gear that they needed. They had asked me, you know, why? And I told them, I can't be there, being approximately their age in America, and not feel that co-responsibility to be active in this fight. It's our fight, and they're physically serving. And so I'm doing whatever I can to sort of support that fight. And then they had friends who were injured a few weeks before in Gaza. So I went to visit them in Tel HaShomer, the rehab center. And I got very close with them. We started doing events for them in the rehab unit. I collected money. We did a Shabbat dinner for expats who were living in Israel. We raised a ton of money, and we did like a huge event there. And we donated money to Soroka Hospital. We ended up, I think, raising like 120K altogether over that summer.
Wow.
And that was
all
just
started by you just saying, hey, you know, I want to.
I can't sit still. I can't sit still while there's people fighting for my existence. To me, Israel is my existence.
Wow. And then October 7.
Whew.
Tell me about if you can and are willing, because I've actually never asked you about your October 7.
My October 7th, we were at a close friend's house that I just met like a few months before that, and I just moved to the area, to Bergen County. She invited us for dinner in her sukkah with a bunch of our friends that we were meeting and, you know, kind of making our own little family unit here with. And we had just finished the meal, and as we were leaving, my friend Guy says to me, something's happening in Israel. And I was like,
this is Shabbat.
This is like the Friday night. It's 11:30 at night, exactly on the dot. When I looked at my watch, something's always happening in Israel, you know?
Something is always happening in Israel.
It's
true.
Yeah, right? It's like it's probably a barrage of rocket, you know, rocket fire, a barrage of rockets.
And which is, by the way, we, you know, and so is, we need to pause. And part of me doing this and having the conversations that I have is to deconstruct this mentality that we have. It's like something is always happening. It's probably a barrage of rockets. Whereas like no country in the world
would tolerate that.
Would forget to tolerate. Would be like... That would become so routine that you'd say, you know, you're in San Diego, you're in Seattle, you know, like other cities that are around the border, and be like, well, it's a barrage of rockets from other countries. Like some, that's not acceptable for me, but that's a reality.
That we've normalized that, yeah, completely.
So
I looked at the watch, at my watch, 11:30. I was like, it'll be fine. We all went home. I didn't even bother turning on the TV. I went to sleep. I get a phone call from my mother-in-law. I think it was like 1-2 o'clock in the morning. She was screaming. She called like 10 times and I got really frustrated. I looked at my husband. I was like, Mom, your mom's calling. Like, answer her. Tell her she's crazy. Why is she calling at this hour or something like that? And she goes, Milchama b'Israel, Milchama b'Israel. There's war in Israel, war in Israel. And I'm like, your mom's being crazy. I turn on. I was like, but just to like... do my due diligence. I turn on American TV, you know, check the news. Nothing's happening. I go back to sleep. I'm like, please tell your mom to chill out. She's probably having like a manic episode or something. She's not mentally ill or anything, but like something must be wrong. Or she's just nervous. She had just broken her leg, you know, whatever. I was like, maybe it's the pain medication. And we went back to sleep and she calls again. I was like, okay, let's go downstairs. Let's turn on the Israeli TV. We have a membership to the Israeli TV. I couldn't get it to work, I think, because I was so flustered. Called my nephew. He told me how to log in. And all of a sudden, we see what's happening. Meantime, I see messages coming in from my mom. I don't know what's happening, but we all get on this like family FaceTime call. I have a brother who lives in Israel. He made Aliyah a couple of years ago with his kids. And we all get on a FaceTime call, like 6 or 7 of us get on a FaceTime call where they're explaining what's going on. And nobody really knows what's happening. And at the same time, my mom is messaging me privately that Omer, Shelly's son, is missing. And she knows I know a lot of people.
Shelly is your mom's sister?
No, she is my cousin.
Oh, Shelly is your cousin.
Yes.
So Omer is your cousin's
son.
Son.
And now, a few years ago, the Surfside building collapse happened in Miami. Mm-hmm. I was living in Florida at the time during COVID. And I went to volunteer there. We opened a field kitchen to supply the families of the victims who were waiting to hear the news or what was going on during the search and rescue efforts. We opened a field kitchen of kosher food. And then the IDF sent in a delegation that I became very close with. I became their like kind of like logistics coordinator, and they also became like family to me. We've been through 3 tragedies since together, which was, you know, like an earthquake in Turkey, and they called me. I sent some stuff over for like, you know, some containers of diapers and things that the civilians were needing there. So I called them. I called, and by the way, 18 minutes before 11:30, we had called the commander of that unit to say happy birthday. Or no, he called us to say happy birthday, but when I called him back, he no longer answered. So I called another Mifaked from that unit and said, listen, my cousin's missing.
This is Yechidat Chilutz Vatzala, the unit for rescue.
Search and rescue.
Which is, I just told you about my best friend who...
This is not 669. This is a different...
He was in that unit on October 7th and recently moved to another unit.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that unit is near and dear to my heart. They've literally become brothers to me. And so... You know, I called him asking for help. This is my cousin. This is what's happening. And he actually answered the phone. And he's like, listen, it's mayhem here. We don't know what's going on, but send me pictures of your cousin. Send me pictures of what he was wearing. Send me tattoos or any scars on his body, identifying markers. And I was like, okay. And I just did it. I was just in robot mode.
So you didn't say his full name. Omer Shem Tov is your cousin. And
yes.
Where was he?
At the Nova Music Festival. At the time, I didn't really understand what that meant, body scars and all that, you know, like why would they need tattoos? And today, obviously, it makes sense. But I called his grandma. I said, send me what he was wearing, you know, whatever. I wasn't going to call Shelly because she was in her own, you know, mayhem. I got the pictures, I sent it over, and then I started posting on Instagram. I have a ton of friends who would be at that festival. And we didn't know the magnitude of what, you know, 7th of October was at that time. I think at this point, they're still running, if you think of it in terms of the timeline. So I started posting on Instagram, if you see this person, please contact me. This is what he was wearing. This is Omer Shem Tov. And I just started texting a bunch of friends who might be there. And then just came in this reality of being glued to the news and not understanding what's happening, just hysterical crying. And then all of a sudden you start getting text messages from all the friends in the community. And as we're glued to the TV, I think I must have fallen asleep from crying so much. But I'm just like watching TV, crying, falling asleep. I organized a Tehillim group for that night right after Shabbat came out. And people came from the community and we just started praying because we didn't know what else to do. It was confirmed that Omer was kidnapped. We had like confirmation.
Tell me about that.
So Shelly received a phone call from one of Omer's friends who said that he was on the Telegram app and he found a video that Hamas released and he needed to send her this video and she was terrified. And her brother Moshe was with her. And so she had him send the little video clip and Moshe watched it. And in fact, it was a blurred video of Omer laying with his hands, you know, tied behind his back. I think it was zip ties on the floor of a pickup truck. His face was blurred with next to another boy whose face was blurred. Now we know that it was Itai Regev, who he was kidnapped with. You could see Omer's clothing, his shirt, the bright yellow shirt, the Ronaldo shirt, jersey he was wearing with the blue shorts. And we could identify also that it was him through his tattoo. So we got that confirmation.
That fact, when I first read about that, and Omer is 23.
Well, he's 21 now. Well, he was 20 21. When he was kidnapped.
He was 20 when he was kidnapped. I got my first tattoo when I was 20. And that fact that Omer's parents knew that her son had been kidnapped by Hamas through the tattoos, that personally for me was a punch in the gut.
It hit home.
Yeah.
You know, it's a weird thing to say, but we were with the lucky ones that we identified that Omer was kidnapped through his tattoos. There were people who are identified that their bodies were found through their tattoos. And that's
murdered. And yeah.
Yeah. So for me, realizing that that's what my friend Yuval was talking about when he needed scars and identifying markers, they knew the magnitude of this, or to some extent.
Yeah.
So we were one of the lucky ones. If you could call that lucky.
And Omer has been a hostage in Gaza since
October 7th.
Since October 7th.
340 days now, 341.
341 days. Then what did you do?
I think I had a panic attack and I had my husband called a friend to bring in a Valium. And she brought it in like 4 o'clock in the morning. She left her house to bring me a Valium because I never take medication or anything like that. So they gave me a Valium so I could sleep a little. And that was essentially it. I woke up the next morning and I'm like, I don't think I realized like what it meant to be kidnapped. I kind of just dissociated from that whole thing. And I opened a war room in my house and through the chats of the community, found out that there were other people that were trying to raise money for IDF soldiers. And I was like, well, this is something I've done before. Let's do it. And I just started focusing on that. And so for the first, I think, month, that's what I did.
Mm. Wait, so that's incredible. Do you realize how incredible what you just said is? Or
Not really.
Sometimes when you live through it, you don't realize. You've just found out your cousin is kidnapped. It sounds like you were broken, as any person would be. But then you jumped into action and said, you know, I don't know what I can do with this, but I can do with that. I can help. I can't help with A right now, but I can definitely help with B.
I don't think that that's that, in, you know, that's just what we do. That's, I think that's just part of our nature. No, isn't that kind of what everyone does? It's just that there's a problem, you fix it, or you try to, and you help in your way. And this was the only thing that I could do.
That's the hope. I, unfortunately, not everyone does that. And I think we'll get to that, because what happens after that month? You spend a month trying to help as much with the IDF. And like, when people hear that as well, it's like, and you know, my wife was doing a lot of that as well while I was thrown into the fight against universities.
Other stuff. Yeah.
You know, what, it's not sending them rifles, it's not sending them like bullets, it's not sending them bombs, it's sending them ceramic vests so, you know, their hearts are and lungs are protected. Yeah. It's sending them helmets, it's sending them shoes, you know, thermal underwear, like things that just to be safe.
Safe and comfortable and warm. And at some point it got cold and it was vests and fleece jackets and hats and gloves and whatever it was. Yeah, I think I called the synagogue. I didn't have a 501 at this point. I knew I needed a 501 because it was going to be a larger scale. And they lent me their 501. They gave me like a sub fund, the synagogue. I think over the course of 2 months, I raised $1 million, which was really cool. And we just started adopting more units and more units, and it was kind of awesome. But yeah, I threw myself into that, and I couldn't sleep and eat. And I think I ran on 2 hours of sleep each night. I also didn't see my kids. I think I had a really hard time with what was happening in Israel, and I couldn't focus on anything else. It was tunnel vision. How can I help? I'm not a fighter. I wasn't a warrior and a lochemet in the army. And so there's nothing I can do on that end. So what can I do? And how can I make it an optimal fighting situation for the soldiers who literally leave their families? And it's also part of like a kind of like a guilt that I experienced. It's
why guilt?
Because back in 2014, I got up and I left and I flew there. And I wish I could do that now. And if I was trained, if I could go back in time, I would go and be a warrior so that I could get up and leave and just go fight. Like, I think about that all the time. Like, it's this guilt of being here somewhat protected in a bubble, not somewhat, compared to what Israelis in Israel are facing. I am protected here in America. And they experience the brunt of everything on a daily basis, whether it's, you know, losing, you know, funds from their work because they're, you know, in reserves, or mothers who are holding down the fort because their husbands are away for months at a time. Kids who are running into bomb shelters. My kids are safe. Why should I be safe? Why should my family be safe while they're suffering? While they're experiencing like what I should be experiencing. It's my destiny too. It's my fate. These are my people. What makes me better than them? What makes it okay for them to be suffering and for me not to be?
But you know, one of the beautiful things is that a lot of people, when they experience guilt, they kind of close off to the world. You know, they you know, like 2020 and everything was happening, people were talking about white guilt and people were hiding the fact we're white. There's wealth guilt. People are hiding the fact that they're rich. And you're like, no, I'm feeling guilt and I am taking that and turning that into action.
Isn't that who we are?
That's who you are, Liat. And that's who I aspire to be. And that's who I hope many of the listeners and people who watch this, who might not be right now, I hope will become. Don't take that for granted.
I don't know. I look at everyone in Israel. I genuinely say this. Everyone runs into
you told
action.
Me we were having lunch at Miznon.
Yeah.
And you said something in Hebrew. I'll say in Hebrew first because it also was an alliteration. And obviously you don't even remember.
No.
You said, I asked you how you do it. And you said, אני לוקחת את הכאב והכעס והופכת אותו לכוח. So I take the pain and the anger and turn it into power.
Into power and purpose, yeah.
And power and purpose. I think a lot of people are still stuck in the pain and anger. And you give them the way of, here's how to turn it. Everyone, all of us feel that pain and anger. Not all of us have that machinery switching into action and purpose.
So interesting. I never really thought about that. To me, it's just who we are as a people. I don't know. Maybe it's that survival, that fight or flight. I just feel that when my people are suffering, you can't just sit home, can't do nothing. You can't just go on about your day.
And then, so when did you switch from trying to help the IDF to advocating for Omer and the other hostages?
So I remember heading over. I had somebody who gave us I ended up finding people who also needed to allocate things. And for one of their units, he was going back to Israel to serve. So we used their house as a warehouse to bag everything and, kind of put everything together that we were sending. And I was about to head out, and the hostage release, the prisoner exchanges started happening, and everyone was glued to the TV and everyone was so happy. And I found myself not being able to watch.
This was in November.
In November.
2023. Yes. 53 days after October 7th.
I think it started day 50?
50, yeah.
50 was the first, and then it was till 54, 55, I think, 55. Yeah. And I was crying in happiness, and everyone was so happy. Everyone was celebrating, and I couldn't, because not everyone was being released. And then I kept, messaging my mom, is Omer one of them? Is Omer one of them? And she said no. And we were just waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting. And once the exchanges stopped, I couldn't live with myself. I couldn't sit anymore. I couldn't.
Well, we have to say, the exchanges stopped because they were supposed to keep going, and the ceasefire was broken.
Right. I couldn't even process that. It was just bottom line, there are still people there.
Yeah.
And I realized Omer was going to be one of those people there. And I realized that I did what I could at this point with the IDF. And of course there were more needs. But something told me that I can't be quiet anymore about this, and how can I help? So I called, I don't even remember who I called. Everything is kind of a blur, but I remember just that was the point where I got in. And I called Shelly, and I called Malki, and I said...
Shelly
is Omer's mom.
Mom, Malki?
Malki is his father.
His father, okay.
And I said, how can I help? And they connected me with the forum in New York.
The
hostage family, the missing and hostage family forum in New York, and... somebody by the name of Omer contacted me, Omer Lubi, and said, "Hey, we have a protest in front of the UN Secretary General's house tomorrow. Do you want to come and speak?"
At that point, have you ever spoken at a protest?
No.
Have you ever been at the front of a protest?
No. I don't think I've ever been at a protest. Huh. That I think about it.
So. You show up outside of the...
Yeah. And the UN. First thing I did actually is I said yes. And then I said, who is the UN Secretary General? I had no idea. And I started researching him. And I found out that he was the former prime minister, president of Portugal. And I have an obsession with Jewish history. And I worked with a lot of students who had to write thesis papers. And so I grew this affinity for learning about Jewish history during expulsions, during pogroms. And one of the papers that one of my students wrote and that I got very interested in was the Spanish expulsion. And I remembered that the Jews went to Portugal, and I started remembering the history that I learned. And I do a lot of historical fiction reading, and I wrote my speech about how the UN Secretary General came from Portugal, where they first offered refuge to the Jews, and then he ended up, you know, the king of King Manuel of Portugal ended up marrying Queen Isabella and King Ferdinand's daughter, and how he, you know, he needs to do better because of their history. They've apologized. The Portuguese government has apologized for things, and they even started offering citizenship to Jews. Who were expelled, their lineage.
So some people would not know, like Queen Isabella is the Queen of Spain.
Yes.
Who married the Portuguese prince.
King.
And she is basically the first person in history that enacted a blood law against Jews. So it wasn't enough that you converted, like, and there were a lot of like conversos that converted away from Judaism to Christianity or to Islam. The fact that you were Jewish by blood made you a second-tier citizen, and that's Queen Isabella's decree. That's where it starts. So you spoke at the UN.
So I spoke at the UN outside of his house, and I was very emotional. And that was it. That's when this journey began of not leaving our people behind, period.
Never leaving our people
Never.
Behind.
Just like, you know, I don't know. I don't have anything to equate it to. I said to you before the show started, I feel, I don't know if everyone is like this, but I feel this motherly responsibility to fight for all of us. I deeply care in my bones about our people.
So what have you been doing? So I've know you've been speaking a lot in the weekly marches for the hostages in Central Park, which I try to be there almost every week.
Yes, you definitely are.
I've seen you speak and set up tents in Times Square. I know you've been traveling.
I traveled around America speaking to different Jewish communities. I even went to Mexico, bringing awareness. I meet lawmakers, congressmen, senators, to see how they can help us push along this humanitarian crisis and see an end to it.
What do they tell you when you meet people that actually have power?
They want to see a deal come to fruition, and you could see the anguish that they feel once we share the connection and what it means. Because how could you not understand that it's literally could have been you, me, their child?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about that, because when Gilad Shalit was kidnapped, and some people might criticize me for this, and I'm not above criticism. But I went to protests to release Gilad Shalit for a deal.
In Israel.
When I graduated from the Hebrew University and I went to take my diploma, I wore a shirt of Gilad Shalit. And of course, people might criticize it now because part of the people who were releasing that deal, you know, Yechiel Sinwar, obviously, but it was easy because it was one person. When we're talking 250, now we're still 101, I find that people have a hard time connecting because there's so many. And people, for lack of better words, find their hostage you know, Hirsch Goldberg Pauline was all of ours, Kfir and Ariel Bibas. But then I met a woman at a protest outside of Colombia. There's a tiny, beautiful baby named Romy, because of she named her after a hostage because she wants her baby
Romy Gonen
to meet Romy Gonen when she comes home.
Wow.
And tell her this is because of you. And I met you and was obviously immediately like drawn.
Excuse me.
But then I found out that Omer suffers from celiacs. My niece suffers from celiacs. I know how hard it is for my sister to figure out even basic dietary stuff for my niece. And my niece is 15. She's 5-6 years younger than Omer. And that to me was a punch, another punch in the gut. And I feel like part of what you're doing is putting a face and a story and the human behind numbers.
That's exactly what we're doing. I think the hardest part, and I think a lot of our families talk about this, it's trying to explain that it's more than just a poster. There's an entire human being behind this who's, it's real. You know,
So tell me about Omer.
Apart from the fact that he has celiacs and asthma and is really suffering, he's a really happy, silly boy. And the best way that I can explain him is really to say, go on his Instagram, the Instagram that I started. It's bring.omer.home. And if you see the videos of him, there are videos I've never seen before that his friends have shared. And I'm just like, I just want to jump through the screen and just like hug him. Like, he's just this lovable, sweet, silly,
very good looking,
very hit. Rachel Goldberg Pollan. Yeah. She calls him the handsome one, the pretty boy.
Pretty boy.
The pretty one. I guess each hostage has kind of like a what defines him or her. Very handsome and as beautiful as he is on the outside, he's also on the inside. Recites Kiddush since the age of 7. Go figure. Like, why? Something in him. I think he just, you know, I say this always, his nickname is Yelid Shemesh, the sunshine boy.
Yelid Shemesh.
He really is. He's just a light. Like, he's just looking to always make people laugh. And go look at some of his videos. He's just so lovable. And I think you could see it through his eyes, or maybe I'm biased, but yeah, he's just a really great kid, loves music. Obviously, he went to the Nova Music Festival, aspires to be a music producer. It's a great brother. He's really close with his siblings, loves spending time with his family.
And what did you learn about his time being held hostage from Itai Regev, who was released and was held captive with him?
Yes.
And Itai was released because he was underage?
Under the age, yes. So we learned a lot, and I think I'm learning little by little more and more. The biggest thing that we learned is that, and I say this, and it almost feels like I'm always constantly repeating myself, but for those who don't know, is that Omer is, Itai said, like the source of hope and strength there. So when Itai was breaking, and I'm assuming there's many moments where you break in captivity, Omer was the one who sort of strengthened him, who somehow found a way to crack a funny joke. But the biggest thing is that Omer and Itai, because Omer knew the blessings for Kiddush on Friday nights, Omer and Itai decided to ration their food. So they were given a bottle of grape juice early on in captivity. And instead of drinking it, they're given like 8 ounces of water a day or something to that effect. Instead of drinking their juice for that day, they received a small bottle of grape juice. They put it away and they saved it for Friday. They said, we're going to save this for Friday. and they received a bag of pretzels and they scraped the salt off their pretzels. And they saved the salt. And then they were given, you know, their portion of bread for that week, which was a quarter pita, you know, quarter pita for Omer, quarter pita for Itay. And one of them was in charge of counting the days. And one of them was in charge of counting the date. And they figured the five Muslim calls to prayer. So they figured about approximately what time it was and after sunset, after the fifth prayer. And they recited the Kiddush. Omer recited the Kiddush because he memorized it, using a piece of toilet paper and putting it on his head as the kippah. And so that was their way of, I guess, you know, keeping hope, retaining their identity, doing something that they could do in captivity that they did in their daily lives.
You know, the, and I've told you this, but I haven't told this to many people. After I first heard you tell this story, I recited the Kiddush for the first time in years. So I grew up in a very interesting household. My grandfather was an atheist. My grandmother is a believer. My dad's sister became observant, religious. So we had all sorts of things. And my grandfather, despite being an atheist, would say the Kiddush every Shabbat when I was a child. But I kind of left that because that wasn't my belief. And it's still not my belief. Hearing Omer's story about the Kiddush, I was like, fuck it. Even if it's not my belief, it's who I am. So, and I've been trying. I haven't been as good, but I've been trying to say the Kiddush every Friday since I heard that story.
It's interesting. I was listening to your bit that Mindy sent me today for the talk you did for them yesterday, and I was thinking about that because you were...
This is for people don't know, probably no one knows. I was on a Zoom call yesterday with a group of Tehillim, a group that recites the Tehillim. They meet Monday to Thursday every night, and every day since October 7, every day is dedicated to one hostage, and we just, yeah.
So, and I was thinking about that because I remember that you told me that you started reciting this Kiddush and you were talking about how you're not a believer. And I was like, well, I wonder why he recited the Kiddush, but you just answered it. It's who you are. By the way, I'm struggling with my belief. I used to be observant, then not observant. And I believed in God for the first few months, I think, of October 7th. And now I have my questions, but... yeah, it's who we are. And I think my father also, I'm not sure if he's a believer, but it's something that we had to do Friday night.
Tell me about Washington, D.C.
So we went to D.C. with like a mini delegation.
This is June 2024.
Is it June? I don't even know.
June or early July 2024.
Yeah. And early July, you're right. And... the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu, came to speak at Congress. And so we went to listen and also sort of make it known that we want, you know, we're there to praying and hoping that he was going to announce a deal to save his people. And both myself and five other family members decided to wear a shirt that said "Seal the Deal" from... you know, something that we had, you know, printed "Seal the Deal Now." And we walked into the gallery of where the Prime Minister gave his speech.
In Congress.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was wearing it with a little blazer over it, just like I am now. And a couple minutes into his speech, all of a sudden officers came and kind of grabbed all of us, I guess, separately now, I know, around the same time, and arrested us for demonstrating in Congress, for wearing the shirt that said "Seal the Deal." And that was the bit of really traumatizing, actually. We were taken into a tunnel because under D.C., there's a tunnel system, I guess, that they use. It was very triggering. pat down. I'll tell you that the whole ordeal lasted about 5 hours, and I had a 5-hour panic attack in tears for 5 hours. It was terrifying. I had flashbacks. It's weird that I call it a flashback. I didn't experience October 7th in Israel, but I had these visions while I was being pat down by the officer of what the hostages were feeling. I was clothed. They're not being clothed. They're being touched by terrorists. I'm being touched by a Democratic police officer who I'm safe in her charge. I have rights here. They don't have rights where they are. We were in a tunnel. It was really hot. It was really muggy. It was really humid. Then we were loaded onto a transport van and the light was shut off. And I was thinking about Omer being in complete darkness in a tunnel. Handcuffed to a wall while we were brought into a cell by ourselves, like each of us.
This is all for wearing a shirt that says "Seal the Deal Now."
Yeah.
You know what? You're so nice and calm. And I've been seeing for 11 months videos of that horrific anti-Semite from Code Pink harassing Congress members with her Code Pink shirt on U.S. Capitol every single day. You show up once with a shirt that says "Seal the Deal Now," you get handcuffed, arrested, pat down,
fingerprinted with a record. Now, the charges were eventually dropped, but we still have a record. Do you know why I'm not upset?
I would be proud to have that record.
So when I was having this panic attack while I was being pat down, Karmit, whose brother was murdered in captivity and her father was murdered on October 7th, Karmit Palti Katsir. As I was coming out of like the corner where they pat me down, she said, "Omel's going to be proud of you." And I don't want him to be proud of me, but yeah, I'm proud of having that now. At the time, I didn't know what it meant. It's just this fear. I'm not upset, not because I don't think it's unfair and people should be put away for burning American flags and all that stuff, but I'm not upset because it's a fraction. Not even a fraction. It's minuscule compared to what the hostages are experiencing on a day to day for nearly a year now. And I owe them that. I owe them to know how terrifying it was for 5 hours to be arrested in a democratic country where I have rights by democratic police officers and I knew I was safe and all that. I owe the hostages that experience of feeling what a fraction of what they felt and what they are feeling, in order to fight harder for them.
Yeah. It's,
and I think that if people felt that for just 30 minutes, they'd all be fighting. It was terrifying.
So I want to talk about everything with you. Unfortunately, I don't have the time, but let's talk about Colombia. At some point, you didn't switch your activism, but you complemented your activism with not just talking about the hostages, but focusing about everything that's happening here in the U.S. as well.
Yes.
You're a Columbia alum.
I am.
You wanted to come to campus on April 26th, a few days after I was blocked, my ID was deactivated. But you couldn't?
I couldn't. That's right. The reason was because I couldn't get onto campus because my Columbia alumni ID was expired.
And the gates were locked and they were only letting people with ID.
Right. And I said, I want to make an appointment to renew my ID. And they gave me some runaround story. I think they were just trying to limit who was coming onto the campus.
I'll get to that in a second. But what were you planning to do there?
I wanted to go onto the encampments and have conversations.
Have you ever had conversations with...
So after my speech at Columbia University, I don't even remember what month it was. It's all kind of a blur. I did go onto the encampments. I spent about 3 hours on the encampments speaking to students who were in the encampments. And I just wanted to humanize us a little bit and have a conversation going and sort of make them question what it is that they were there for.
And what happened?
when I came to enter the encampment, they said I had to read a bunch of rules. And I said, I read them. And they said, you read them so quickly. I said, yeah, I did read them so quickly, because those rules don't apply to me. You can't create rules for a public space. I know my rights. I'm not a 20-year-old who's afraid of, I'm just not, you know. And I walked onto the encampment and they said, the Zionist, someone watch her. The Zionist is here. And I just looked back and I smiled. And
how did they know you were a Zionist?
It's a great question. Oh, I was wearing Omer's shirt.
Mm. So they knew you were Jewish.
They knew I was Jewish. Yeah, I didn't speak Hebrew.
You didn't even say anything about nothing. Israel's right to exist.
Nothing.
They saw a Jew. They called you a Zionist.
They called me a Zionist. Yeah. And they said, somebody follow her around. And so there was somebody literally following me around the encampment. And I said, I asked her, why are you following me around? She's like, to make sure that you're not going to instigate something. I said, okay, I'm not going to instigate anything, but sure, no problem. Like, I don't have an issue with it. You can watch me as much as you want. And then I just smiled at everyone who was sitting down and everyone was kind of staring at me. And I found a group of kids. This one gentleman made eye contact with me, and I said, he made eye contact. So I asked him if I could sit down and have a conversation, and I just listened for the first hour. Why are you here? Have you ever been to Israel? What are your thoughts? And I wanted to listen to understand where he was coming from, why he was there. And then I started sharing my perspective. And
did you tell him about Omer?
I did. And
what was his reaction?
He said, I'm really sorry for your cousin. That's horrible. It shouldn't be.
I'm sensing a but.
But why is there, you know, militarization in the West Bank? And, you know, he started coming out with all these things, and there's so too much surveillance, and they're not, you know, they're not free. And I said, it's really interesting that you should say that, because there's a woman standing right above me here who's observing me and surveilling me. So is that justified? She's here to make sure that I'm not going to start any trouble. I said, that's the exact same thing that's happening in the West Bank. Terrorists come out of the West Bank, and so we have an army there to protect us from...
Wait. I'm sorry. You're too nice. You're too nice, and I'm...
We're not going to get anywhere.
You're talking, your cousin is being held hostage by the people that this, I'm sorry, you're a Columbia student, but this fucking idiot student at Columbia, yeah, who's 20-year-old, is cheering on the captors. Your cousin was taken from a music festival, and he's talking with you about surveillance in the West Bank, and tells you, oh, I'm sorry. It's like saying, I'm sorry for your loss, but I support the murderers. And I want to add another thing, because a few days after your ID was, you weren't able to get in, someone with no ID went into Colombia. Nahla Al-Aryan, who is the wife of someone who was convicted with conspiring for terrorism. He was deported from the U.S. in 2006, deported to Turkey after he pled guilty for conspiring to and giving money to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. She doesn't have an ID. She was there in the encampments. So I don't buy all this. Colombia was trying to monitor if its Jews don't get into the encampments. The students were... How do you stay so, have so much poise?
I don't think it's going to get us anywhere if we just all start yelling at each other. You're not going to you're not going to be able to get any, you're not going to be able to relay any information to them. And look, my goal was to humanize us and to see if we can get someone on the same page. If they're looking to end Palestinian suffering, because there was a sign on a tent that he was sitting in front of that said, Palestinian children deserve to grow up.
100%.
And I agree with that. And I said, I agree with that statement. You know, children in Gaza deserve to grow up.
It should be children deserve to grow up.
Agree. So
no
I
need
said
to qualify it by Palestinian, Israeli, El Salvadorian. It doesn't matter. Every child deserves to grow up.
I agree. If I come and start yelling at him, we're not going to get any exchange of information. Mm-hmm. My point was to get them to understand that if they truly care about Palestinian lives and children, then they should be calling for the release of the hostages, because releasing the hostages will end the hostilities in the region. And then Palestinian children wouldn't suffer, right? Yeah. They wouldn't die. They would be able to grow up. And when I brought that idea up to them, they said, that's not our means. What can I do by calling for a ceasefire and calling to release the hostages? Why is the government going to listen to me? I said, so why are you sitting here? Like, that's your call for BDS is a long-term solution. Like you have need to, you want Colombia to show their investments and blah, 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 blah. Let's do something for them to be able to grow up now. Yeah. Let's bind together. We have a lot more in common than we have difference. We both believe in humanity.
I was once at a protest outside of Baruch College, and it's the first time that I saw Hamas flags and Hezbollah flags waved in front of my face. And I was like, does anyone want to have a conversation? And no one wanted to have a conversation. Just like, just going one by one, asking them. There was police in the middle, you know. And then at some point, someone said, why should I have a conversation with you when 40,000 are dead? You know, forget the fact that about half of those 40,000 are terrorists. Forget the fact that the numbers are coming from the terrorist organization. They've been disputed. Right. But let's take you on face value. And I told him, so there won't be 40,000 more.
What did he say?
You really want to know?
Yeah.
Fuck you, Zionist.
Wow.
So there's place for conversation. I'm glad there are people like you. Yeah.
It's funny, something I've been wanting to do for a while now, but I'm kind of scared to do it by myself, is just to open like a table and says, my cousin is a hostage in Gaza. Ask me anything. Just for rent, because I feel like I'm an echo chamber. Yeah. People who follow me, people who follow you, it's all us. I want strangers to be able to ask and humanize us and invite. I'm not here to attack anyone.
But. Yeah. Before we finish, I want to ask you about the day after. One day, we will all be home. What will be next for you, Liat?
What will be next? I think it's to be able to get to the important stuff is to take back our narrative. And I would like to start doing it now, but take back our narrative, explain, educate people with history, create open dialogue, bridge gaps, be able to really throw myself into the right for Jewish civil rights here in America. I think the only thing I can see going forward for myself is fighting for us, because no one else is going to do it.
I really hope people that are listening to this, you know, are not driving, because I don't know how I could drive listening. Ugh. So we're going to try with something a little bit more light.
Okay.
I end every episode with what I've been calling the Jewish lightning round, a series of questions. There's no right or wrong answers. Okay. I just say whatever comes to mind.
Okay.
I tell people that you get one pass and I get to decide whether you get the pass. Like, you get as many passes as you want. Liat Corinne Rubin Ungar. What is one thing people don't know about you?
Oh my gosh, I'm an open book. What do people not know about me? I'm 37. I don't know.
Right. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
People like non-Jews?
Yeah. Or Jews? I don't know.
We just want peace. We just want to live and be accepted and not have to fight constantly for our survival.
What is your favorite curse? Hebrew, English, Spanish, Ladino?
Semic.
Semic. When was the last time you cried?
On the way here. Actually, on this show.
On this show. You cry a lot?
I cry a lot. I do. At least a few times a day.
I wish I could cry as much.
Take it away from me. I'll give it to you in a heartbeat.
If you could have any person over for a Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Omer Shem Tov.
I want to come.
With pleasure.
What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Pesach.
I don't even need more questions. Like, I think everyone understands both answers. When do you feel safest?
In Israel.
When do you feel least safe?
I don't feel unsafe.
What gives you hope?
Us. Israel. The Jewish people. Us coming together.
What's the first thing that comes to mind when you think about the words Jewish civil rights?
You.
What's the second thing?
Safety for my kids.
Finally, every episode I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want the listeners to donate to this week?
Bishvil HaMachar.
Bishvil HaMachar? Tell me more.
It's an organization that helps combat soldiers process their traumas by taking them on a week-long intensive trip nearby, and they do a lot of heavy processing. And I'm actually hosting them in a few weeks here in America, in New York, in America.
So if people want to Google them, like, do you have an American name?
Bishvil HaMachar, I think. If you want, I can check it after the show, and maybe you can link it here. But
yeah.
It's an exceptional organization. And I don't think we realize that, yeah, the fighting may end, but their fight, what the soldiers have seen and are continuing to see, it's a lifelong battle.
Liat, where can people find you?
Instagram?
Yeah. What's your...
At Liat Corinne, LeatCorinne.
And what's Omer Shemtov's Instagram?
Bring.omer.home. Bring Omer, Omer, .home.
I've been wanting to do this, to have this conversation for a while. We've had many conversations. I've been telling people, and I don't like praising people in their face, but I've been telling people that you are one of the strongest women and people I've ever seen, because you don't pretend to not have pain. I've seen you cry in public. I've seen you scream your lungs out. I've seen you be poised. I've seen you do everything. And I told you, I'm in this fight with you till the end.
Thank you.
So I'm really glad to say here I am with Liat Corinne Rubin Ungar.
I love you, Shai. I'm really glad to have met you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."